From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Ross Reynolds. Big data refers to crunching enormous amounts of data to gain insight. For example, predictions of flu outbreaks based on Google searches for the term. So how is big data being used? Should we be concerned about what it might mean for our privacy? Ken Cukier is the data editor for The Economist. He writes for The New York Times and Financial Times. And Ken is the co-author of Big Data, a revolution that will transform how we live, work, and think. Ken, thanks so much for coming by. We appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely.
How is big data different and new? I mean, haven't insurance companies for years collected data about health in order to set health insurance rates and data about cars to set car insurance rates?
Well, that's absolutely right. They have used data. So in one way it's new is that these techniques that used to cost millions of dollars for only an elite group of organizations to do have been democratized, that it takes seconds to do where it may have taken weeks, and it's done at marginal cost of zero when it used to cost millions of dollars. That's the first way. But the second way it's changing is that we are taking data that used to, say, in the case of the insurance premiums, be priced based on our group association and drilling down to the individual. And in the past where we, or today, if you will, we're looking at maybe 15 known factors that give us the outcome that we've had based on our, you know, models with which we've understood the world, we now may be looking at 1,000 variables in a model that has different weightings that is far vaster than we can actually comprehend. In fact, it's the machine that is running the correlations and identifying this, and we have to then peer into the algorithm to discover the inferences that it's making because we didn't know it in advance.
You say the essence of big data is the ability to predict. When you started researching this book, give me some examples of some things that surprised you that big data could do that maybe you didn't realize they could do.
Yeah, there's so many of them. So the first one is probably spot things before it happens. This is strange. So an example would be a car. When a car engine breaks down, it doesn't break down all at once. What happens is something is going wrong, or rarely does it all go kaput at once. You sort of, when you're driving, you sort of feel it, and it feels different. You hear it, and the engine just sounds different. If we put sensors into the engine and throughout the different parts of it, we might be able to pick up that the vibration changes or that the heat that it emits changes. And if we do a correlation and look at the pattern of a breakdown, we would be able to spot this anomaly and identify it as saying, it looks like the fan belt is going to break in the next 2 or 3 days. We need to bring the car to a service station now before the fan belt breaks to replace it. And that's called predictive maintenance. So UPS has 60,000 vans on the road. They cannot afford a van to stop on a breakdown because if it does, it means they've got to get another van out there. There's people waiting for packages. There's people waiting for pickups. It's a disaster. So it's far better for them to actually monitor the vehicles by dataizing different parts of the engine so that they can find out exactly when things need to break before they break down.
Well, that's a great example of how it benefits a business and how it benefits an individual who might have a car that they could predict when it was headed toward a breakdown. How does big data benefit government?
Yeah. So government, we're in the age of austerity, and government needs to do more with less. And so you can imagine that the governments are going to be using data in lots of different ways to provide public services and reform them and do things new. So in the case of New York City, one of the problems they have is overcrowded buildings. And they get lots of complaints for this. And the problem with overcrowded buildings is not just for the individuals involved. It's that these are far more likely to burst up into flames. They're breeding grounds of crime, of drugs, but most importantly, of a fire. And when there's a fire in an overcrowded building like this, the firemen are more likely, far more likely to be injured or to die in those blazes. So they really have to crack down on them. They have a 311 number, and they get about 65,000 complaints per year on this, but they only have 200 inspectors. So the inspectors don't know which are the serious complaints, what aren't. But if you throw data at it, a lot of it, you can find out that in their model, what are the number of ambulance calls to an address? Crime calls to an address? Has there been a utility cut at that address? Has there been a financial lien on the property? Has there been new brickwork done in the property? All of these things in the model increase the prediction. And so in the past, when it was based on it, just on what they thought were the good complaints, about 15% of the time, the inspectors would come and issue a vacate order, which is the stiffest sanction, get out. Now it's about 70% of the time that inspector comes to do it. So it's a fivefold increase in efficiency.
Ken Cukier is my guest. He's the co-author of Big Data, and we're explaining what it is, what it does. How is that useful for people like you who are journalists? There's a sort of database reporting thing that many organizations have now, someone who's in just to analyze data. Give us some examples of how it's been useful in your trade.
Sure. So journalism is actually undergoing a revolution because of data. And one way that's been happening is how we can interview the database and learn from it in the same way that we used to do that with our sources. During the Vietnam War, for example, we would go to the general's tent and hear the briefing of what was said about the progress in the war. What the WikiLeaks disclosure was able to do was to take a lot of the State Department cables that had been private and expose it. And so what The Guardian did in the UK was they looked at the incidences of IED attacks, improvised explosive devices, where it took place in Afghanistan, when it took place, the date, and the casualty rate. And they could identify and create a map over time that tracked the progress of the war. So in the past, you had, if you will, anecdotal, subjective-based reporting based on what the general told you. Now you could also look at the data as another tool with which to understand the conflict. Now, the data doesn't always tell the truth, just like individuals don't. You have to bring your suspicion to it as well. What does the fact that there's fewer casualties mean? Does it mean that you're winning the war? Or does it mean that you're treating people who've been disabled so much better that they're living where and before they perished? We don't know the answer to that, but it's the beginning of the process of reporting.
You know, there's the old phrase, garbage in, garbage out. Seems like big data could be more garbage in, more garbage out. How, does big data in any way overcome that kind of inherent problem with analyzing information?
You know, it never overcomes it perfectly, but it does overcome it a bit. What we're finding is that data that is less clean can still be very useful when you increase the order of magnitude by many orders.
See, I've heard that before. It doesn't make sense to me, so I need to get you to explain that.
Sure. So take the case of machine translation. So if you want a computer to translate one language to another, the way that it's done now is very astute. It's called statistical machine translation, and it just scores the probability that a word in one language is the suitable alternative for the word in another. Now, when you have a small database, for example, say millions of pages of data in French and English, this is the case of in the 90s with IBM, it works, but it only works so well. It doesn't go beyond that. Now, if you try to engineer the algorithms better, you get a little bit of a pump up of improvement, but not much. Google stepped in around 2006, and they poured in not a billion pages of text, but they poured in, not millions, but billions of pages of text. They increased the amount of data that they had by many orders of magnitude. However, the data was less clean. It was basically the flotsam and jetsam of the internet. It was not just European Union documents that were translated to a high standard, but it was corporate websites as well. And so when they added more of the data, even though it was messier, it was less clean and less pristine and perfect, the outcome that they got in terms of better scored predictions, probabilities that one word was the right substitute for another, was far higher. And as a result, now if you go to Google Translate, it works extremely well. Not because the algorithm is better, although it is. It's not because the processors are stronger, though they are. It's because they have more data.
Have there been many examples of where big data just was wrong? I mean, it looked as though it should be right. The algorithm seemed to be working, but then in the real world, it didn't work.
Well, yes, although it's not the problem of big data per se, but in the way that it was implemented, and it's certainly the financial crisis. There you had Wall Street quants, the quantitative analysts, who had huge models that both tried to find ways that would get you the best possible premium on your money at the lowest possible risk. But the problem there is that their assumptions were wildly imperfect, and the algorithms were great at times of constant trading, but it lost all of its common sense when there was market distress. And the idea of quantifying risk in the way that they did was completely preposterous, as we now know.
I was just reading a story about how humans need to provide context to big data, and they gave the example of when Romney, during the debates, talked about Big Bird. And you needed a person to look at all those things popping up in Twitter to tell you there wasn't a sudden interest in the Children's Television's workshop. There was a political context to it. Does there need to be a human element?
Certainly when there is a human interface, there does, right? So in this case of Twitter, because they were dealing with sentiment analysis, that is the technique with which he was parsing the huge stream of information from Twitter, but they were giving it back to an individual, then you needed to know that Big Bird was one thing and not another. But let me give an example where you kind of don't need a person. You don't need the touch of a human. And the case would be a self-driving car. The way that we have self-driving cars today is not because we are very good at programming cars in terms of how to turn and when to turn. We've tried to do that. It's a really difficult problem. In fact, it's so complex, it's kind of depasses our ability to do it. So what we did instead, the revolution, was we used data. We have, 25 streams of different information in real time flowing in. Computer vision, it can tell if it's a red light or if it's a green light, and it follows predictive abilities. It knows what to do in these situations. Now, you don't need the human touch to know that this is a pile of leaves or this is a bicyclist who's on my left-hand side. The data can just run the correlation, and it's good enough.
I'm talking to Ken Cukier, co-author of Big Data, A Revolution That Will Transform How We Live, Work, and Think. One would hope it's for the better. We're at 206-543-5869. That's 206-543-KUOW. It's 800-289-5869. You can write to us, conversation@kuow.org. What about the possible issues with privacy when it comes to big data being collected about us?
Yeah. So privacy is a problem today in a small data universe. It's going to be a bigger problem tomorrow in a big data universe. The reason why is that things that are considered personally identifiable today are our names and our social security numbers, for example. Our cell phones are personally identifiable now, the numbers. But tomorrow it's going to be a lot more than that. So, for example, the way that we walk, we don't particularly think of ourselves as sort of identifying who we are. But our smartphones have sensors on them. And the way that you walk and the way that I walk are probably different. Now, I'll make the bold claim, no two people walk in the same way so you can identify everyone together. That's a little bit too bold. We do know that some people share many common traits in their DNA. We know that sometimes fingerprints do look remarkably similar. So it wouldn't be perfect, but it's good enough that as we have our sensors that may monitor how we walk for the purpose of, however, correlating it with whether we want a sugary soda drink when we pass a vending machine, we're going to be in a universe in which many things that we do, just the very act of living, give off a trace that identify us, and we might be uncomfortable with that. So we probably need new rules in how we govern this information.
Exactly. It's sort of assumed that we, certainly on the web, when we give out some information, no one asks us if they can take that information. The default assumption is it could be used any way you want to. Is that a correct way to operate with these concerns about privacy? Should we be asked to opt in rather than you can't even ask to opt out for a lot of these things?
Well, it turns out that what you've just described is actually the generally perceived notion of how these interactions work online, but the reality is more subtle and worse than you're describing.
Worse, okay.
Worse. And the reason why is you have been asked. So when you download an app, say it's for an alarm on your iPhone, right? Or it's to take photographs and doctor those photographs in funny ways. You agree to the terms and services. That is called notice. You have given your consent. That's called consent. And together, this is a legal regime, notice, and consent. Okay? Now, was it a meaningful notice? Because you're not a lawyer. It was 300 pages of all capital letters on your smartphone screen that you'd have to swipe through. You didn't look at it. That was not perhaps meaningful notice. Was it legitimate consent? Well, you did click the terms and conditions. You entered into a contract. Now, you might not agree with that, but you did. So they're collecting it. And now you could say, well, this is just simply to use the product. I didn't know it was getting all of my contacts, every phone call I make and the phone number that I go to, my GPS location, because some of these apps do collect all of these things. So it seems so wildly overbroad that it's not that the app uses it for what it's delivering you, right? Then again, it was a free app. What do you think their business model is? Mm-hmm. Okay, they're collecting data. That's the business that they're in, and they're reusing it in different ways. So you have given your notice and consent. You have essentially opted in. So maybe it makes sense to redraw the rules a little bit and not govern the collection at notice and consent, but to govern the usage. It's difficult and hard to do, but it maybe makes more sense.
I mean, I can just hear the data collection companies, should that ever be proposed by any lawmaker, I don't think that would go down very well.
Well, what you need, it depends on who you are, but some companies, large companies, need legal certainty. So they would rather have a system whereby they can have the visibility and the predictability of what the rules are, rather than a case today whereby the legal fiction of notice and consent is kind of passes its sell-by date, but is still around, but still might bite them.
It's interesting. Our friends over in Redmond at Microsoft are doing a very public advertising campaign trying to kind of undermine people's trust in Google by implying that Google's taking all your information and using it for these nefarious ways. So that's certainly they're just doing it for their business advantage, but that's a way of perhaps shaming companies into changing their policies or at least raising awareness among people about how this information might be used. Is that a good idea?
Let me actually go a step further and say, actually, what you're seeing from Microsoft is that they are turning privacy policy into a differentiator for their business and their business model. If you're in Redmond, what does the world look like? You have an expiring business model from the era of the 1970s in computing of packaged software, and you see that search and online revenue is growing, Google. Facebook is growing, is doing what it's doing in terms of relationships. And you're really not part of those businesses. You have businesses in there. You're a non-entity in them. So what they're doing is an amazing attempt to recast their business around policy issues, in this case, around privacy. So they're staking their future of their business on doing what they perceive that people will want, which is to protect their privacy. It's a very interesting thing, and it's more than just marketing and sort of a pretense. This is about their business.
Ken Kukia, you mentioned at the beginning of the interview, one of the new things about big data is that it's relatively inexpensive to get in and use this material. But aren't the repositories for big data very few? I mean, you've got Google and a few other companies that have all this information. Should we be concerned about their size and the fact that at some point they could just say, no, you can and you can't look at it to the detriment of society at large?
Well, yes and no. I mean, on one hand, big data is more than just what the commercial sector is amassing about us. So, for example, you can imagine a gene bank in which a lot of DNA sequences are going into or is going to help us treat diseases better than ever before. And this will be, in some way, part of a data commons. So it's going to be used by many researchers. So it's not all going to be proprietary data. Insofar as it's proprietary data, at the same time, we have to recognize that the company invested a lot of money and labor into collecting it and should be able to use it. Amazon recommendations are very good, and so I'm a happy Amazon customer. Now, at what point does this become a barrier to entry for new rivals, or does it become unhealthy? Traditionally, in antitrust law, we don't know because we've never looked at the scale of data as the touchstone of an antitrust abuse. But we're going to have to get there. And so we should apply the same rigor that we did in an offline small data setting for other goods, whether it was railway cars or telecoms or electricity, and now apply it to data and think long and hard about what does it mean to have an unhealthy dominance and scale in data.
Ken Kukia, thank you so much for stopping by. I've really enjoyed and learned a lot from our conversation. I appreciate it.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks a lot.
The book is called Big Data, A Revolution That Will Transform How We Live, Work, and Think. David Hyde produces the conversation with Arwin Nix. We get production help from Hannah Byrne and Amber Cortez. Bernard Ouellette is our engineer. From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Ross Reynolds.